Okay, let's begin. So let me begin by answering the question that was just asked. Can one define variables to be real? Let me call that simplifying. Let's assume you want to simplify an expression. Do you have an example for an expression that can only be simplified if something is real? Let's take square root of x squared, and if you simplify that, it's still square root of x squared. But if we know that x is positive, then this would simplify to just x. So there's a global variable that one can set. And if you use certain variables and the same name always has the same meaning in your notebook, then you can set that variable. Assumptions. Many of these global variables starting with the dollar are kind of configuration variables. For example, your license ID would be stored in a variable that's probably called license ID with the dollar sign in front. The dollar sign, again, is just used to make sure that you don't accidentally use this variable for something else. Assumptions. And we set that to x is non-negative. And if we call the simplify again, then we get x out. And we can also ensure that x is real. So this element sign, you get it by typing escape, lm, escape. Yes?
So these notebooks are like in the CDF format? Is there any way to...
No, they're in the notebook format, .nb. You should be able to, yes, exactly. You should be able to download it and then just double click it and it should start. And if x is real, then that, of course, no, it simplifies as well, of course, because x squared will still be non-negative. Does this answer your question? It probably does. Okay. I didn't mention yesterday conditionals, that is, if statements and similar things. So for example, if one is larger than b, a, b, that's an if expression. An if expression has three arguments. First, the condition, and then the value if the condition is true, then the value if the condition is false. It's simply similar to the question mark operator in C, or there's an if-then expression in Python, or respective statements in C and Fortran. And of course, the result is b, because 1 is larger than 2 is actually false. There's also a which expression. Let me highlight this one here. And which takes a sequence of conditions and values. For example, if I is 1 and j is 1, then the result should be 1. If I is 1, the result should be 2. Else, if j is 1, the result should be 2. Else, if true, that is always the case. So if none of these conditions match, then the result should be 0. And I put this into a matrix. Remember table with I and J. This is just the 4x4 matrix that comes out. So the matrix will then look like this. If I is 1 and J is 1, that's this case. If only I is 1, if the first row has 2, the first column has 3, and all the other values are set to 0. Yes.
So going back to the assumptions list, how complicated of assumptions can you make? Like, for example, can you make the assumption like alpha squared plus beta squared equals 1?
Yes.
Okay.
You can make arbitrarily complicated assumptions. Now, simplify may not be able to use the assumption if it's formulated the wrong way. So if it's a complicated relation and simplify never encounters that complicated relation while simplifying, it won't be used. But maybe if you reformulate it, it would be used. But you can have arbitrarily many assumptions, and obviously if x is larger than 0, then it deduces that x is also real and not complex, and so on and so forth.
I was wondering
about
why does it give x?
Why does it give x?
No.
Oh, look, no, that's better. Yes, thank you. Maybe I didn't hit enter before. Yes, this is the absolute value of x, of course, not x. Does this make more sense? So before, it was assuming that x is positive. Let's say x is a real number and x is positive. And in that case, of course, the absolute value is not necessary. And you just get x. Remove that. Then you get the absolute value of x.
One thing about the which you have here. So there's a list of different conditionals, right?
So in the which expression, you have an expression and the value, a condition, sorry, condition, value, condition, value, condition, value, and so on.
But the last two parts, true and zero, what does it mean?
Yeah, so these expressions, so the conditions are evaluated in order from left to right.
Right.
If this condition matches, this is the result.
Okay.
If this doesn't match, it looks at this one. If it doesn't match, it looks at this
all
one.
Right.
And the expression true is always true. So it's a fallback option that matches all the time. So in cases, I mean, it's like an else statement or a default in a switch statement, if you know other languages. Okay. Yesterday, I wasn't completely explicit about the distinction between a function and an expression. And mathematicians are always very strict about that. Sine is a function. Sine of x is an expression. As a physicist, we don't care about that because, I mean, it is really the same thing, right? It's really a detail. And unfortunately, in computer science, this detail may matter. So you need to know about this distinction. So there is sine, for example. And if you write sine, then the result is sine. Mathematica knows the sine function, and this is a function. Sine is a function. And if you write sine of x, then it's an expression. It's a sine value, sine function evaluated at x, where x is unknown. And this is also a function. This uses this strange syntax. So this is sine evaluated at one point and then made a function again. So this is, again, the sine function. This is equivalent to the sine up here. I need the hockey stick again. And if you take, oh, wow. And if you take this expression and write x in square brackets at the end, let me evaluate that, then you get sine of x, proving that this expression here is really equivalent to sine. That is a function. And you take this function, evaluate it at x, then you're going to get, again, this expression, sine of x. This is another way of defining a function with a function operator. This means you have the expression sine of x, and you turn this expression into a function by making x a variable. And this is equivalent to this, or this. It's just a different way of writing this down. You write function and have an explicit name instead of having an anonymous argument and writing the ampersand. But the ampersand corresponds to the keyword function here.
Y and sine.
Yes, exactly, x comma y, and then you have sine x plus cosine y. Of course, you don't have to use the values down there, but you can do that. And this corresponds to writing hash 1 and hash 2 in this anonymous syntax. We don't invent any names. Okay, now to make the distinction a bit more clear, I explained d yesterday. D is the operator that corresponds to a total derivative. If we take the derivative of the sine function, what is the result? What do you guess? So sine is a function. Nothing in sine depends on x. So you take a derivative of sine with respect to x, the result is 0, which is, of course, not what you want. But from mathematical's point of view, that makes sense. And this is the one that you know. If you have the expression sine of x, then you can take a derivative with respect to x, and then you get the cosine. There's another function called derivative, which takes a partial derivative. That is independent of the name that you choose. When you choose a partial derivative, you have to say with respect to what argument to take the derivative. The arguments are just numbered. So this takes the derivative of the sine function with respect to the first and only argument, which is the cosine function. Again, it's the cosine function with the special syntax that Mathematica uses here. And if you take a derivative of sine of x of the expression, then Mathematica does something really strange. Because sine of x, Mathematica doesn't know what x is. So it doesn't know whether sine of x, I mean, it, It doesn't know how to interpret that as a function. You're telling Mathematica here that sine of x is a function, and you can take a partial derivative of it. Mathematica doesn't know what x is, therefore it can't take the partial derivative, so you just get the result back, sine of x and the partial derivative of that. It's just that thing in a different syntax. Mathematica hasn't done to that. Of course, it doesn't make sense, because we know that sine of x actually is not a function. It's a value. It's a scalar. It's a number, so you can't take a partial derivative. But if you say sine of x and partial derivative, actually, let's just do that. That's right. Sine of 1, partial derivative. Yeah, still. So whenever Mathematica doesn't know how to evaluate something, you just get the result unevaluated back, which is what happens here. Okay. I hope this makes the distinction between functions and expressions and values a bit more clear.
If you had derivative 2 and sine x, x, then it would do it? No. In
what line?
Input 24.
Here?
Yeah, if you wanted to make this work.
No, you can't make it work because sine of x is not a function.
You can make it with the.
No, but if you had derivative and then 2, and then your arguments were sine x and x, and you're, does that not mean that you're taking the derivative?
Like this?
Yes. And
no. Derivative expects in here a function, and sine x is not a function. Sine x is the value of the sine function at x. So what you can do here is you can write it like this. Then you have a sine function, and then the result is the cosine function. But once you write sine of x, then you don't have a function anymore. It's just an expression, and you can't take a partial derivative of it. Next, I want to introduce a bit more of the facilities for processing lists, for handling lists in Mathematica. So I used table yesterday. Here's also a function called range. Range 10 just returns a list of the numbers of 1 to 10. Duh. And you can take the first element of the list, and I assign it to a variable called list. List is a variable name. In mathematics, you typically have variable names that are just single letters, x, a, b, c. But in a program, you can also use multiple letters if you prefer that. So here, this is just a variable that is called list. That is the first element of the list. The last element of the list is 10. You can take the first three elements of the list. That's 1, 2, 3. You can drop the first five elements of the list. That's 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You can append x to the list. That appends a new element to the list. Then you have 10 and another element added, just happens to be x, not a number. So lists can have arbitrary elements, doesn't have to be numbers. And you can join two lists. So this is the original list, and there's another list, x, y, z. And the result, of course, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and x, y, z at the end.
Can you position them as you want?
Well, you can use take and drop if you want. You can take the first three elements, and then x, y, z, and then the other three. So take three and drop three are kind of the opposites of each other. Take three takes the first three elements, and drop three removes the first three elements. So you can take three, drop three, and put something else in between.
The append function just puts it at the end of the
yes.
list, right? There's no way of having an extra option that it puts it in.
No, but you can use join for that,
right,
if you want.
The same you were saying.
So join joins two lists, and appends an element, not a list. That's a difference. So you can use create a list from a single element and then join that. Now it's getting confusing. If you have a list of lists, that is, of course, is also possible. This here is a 2x2 matrix with the elements 1, 2, 3, 4. It's just a list of lists. And if you flatten them, then you get the single lists. All the nesting goes away when you have a single list with the elements 1, 2, 3, 4. Sometimes convenient if you're an expression and you get lists and lists of lists and you don't really care about the structure, you can get rid of the structure. There are additional arguments to flatten to say which levels of the list should be removed. Remove only one level, the outermost, the innermost, levels 4 to 6, and so on. And you can also partition the list. Partition means you split it in groups. In this case, groups of three. Then you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's kind of the opposite of Latin. Remember, list had 10 elements originally. Partition dropped the last one because it doesn't fit, because the length was not a multiple of 3. Okay. I highly recommend using Mathematica's help functions if you type. It's probably not visible because not the text is much too small. There's, of course, several entries for lists. And there's one list manipulation. And this does here Mathematica guide. Guide is kind of a beginner's guide. And if you click on that, and I promise it's actually readable on the screen, then you get examples of list manipulation. And down here in references is a long list of all the functions of what you can do with a list. For example, you can construct lists in this table and array and range, get elements of lists, which is first, last, take, drop, and so on. Rearranging lists is flatten, join, partition, applying functions to lists, there is map and apply, and the slash add and the add operator are explained here. Oh, there's transpose for matrices, reverse, change the order, you can sort lists, and so on. There's the riffle function that we had yesterday, and so on and so forth. So if you want to do something with a list and you're thinking of defining that yourself, that function, then I rather recommend going to the help desk and looking what's available there, because there's probably something built in that's already there. Next, I want to talk a bit more about pattern matching that I only mentioned briefly yesterday. There's a select function. Let's take list. List is still our list with 10 elements. And this selects certain elements of the function. And this second argument to select is a function that describes which element you want. That function is supposed to return true or false. And this function says the element is larger than or equal to 5. It's a function because of the ampersand. So this gives you all the elements that are larger than or equal to 5. That works. You can also select all the elements where the modulus, if you divide the element by 2 is 0. That, of course, gives you the even elements of the list. Let me define a slightly more complicated list here. Call it list 2, because the elements 1, 2, 3, x, y, z, x squared, and x cubed. And now we're using pattern matching to get elements. That is the cases functions. You know already underscore is a pattern, and integer is a condition on a pattern. So you get all the patterns that match integer, that are integer numbers. This is kind of like the type again, but the type is not associated to the list element. You use the type when you match a pattern. So here you get all the list elements that are integers, which is 1, 2, 3, because x, y, z are symbols. They are not integers. Here, I take all the list elements that match the pattern something squared. Underscore can be anything and anything squared, which is x cubed, of course. Sorry, x squared, which is just one of the elements that we have here. Here, I take all the elements that match the pattern something to the power of something, which is x squared and x cubed.
Sorry, what's the difference between select and cases
then? It's very similar. Select expects a function, and the function needs to return true or false. Cases expect a pattern.
Okay.
And the pattern either matches or doesn't match. And of course, there are functions where you have a pattern that transforms that into a function. Yes?
So mathematics
is
not able to tell the difference between z to the 1 versus...
Yes. So this pattern matching matches on the form that you see here. It doesn't use mathematical rules as simplified would. Internally, x to the first power is simplified to x. And if you output x in a tree form, let's just do that. Then you get just x. This is again, not very useful. And if you have x squared in tree form, then you see it's the power function x and 2. And when Mathematica uses pattern matching, it looks at the internal representation, and it doesn't know that x is the same as x to the first power. That is inconvenient when you want to use some look at mathematical identities, but it also means that Mathematica internally works in a straightforward manner.
What if in your list you have something that it's like x squared y, and you want to select those cases?
Well, let's just do that. Let's add another element to list 2, x squared times y, like this.
Yeah.
So this doesn't match, and this doesn't match. And what you could do, so you want cases. So you want x squared y times anything should match, or what do you want? But
I was thinking more if instead of the so yeah, okay, it takes the x to the cube, which is x squared times x.
Okay, now I'm confused myself. Help. I'm puzzled. I'm having the blackboard effect here. What if I put y here? Does this make sense? There's something strange with parentheses. Okay, I would have expected that pattern to work. I'm very confused.
Yeah, but we said it. What if you put it in explicitly with the multiplication function?
So I can give the pattern a name, and then it works. Pardon? No, underscore matches different things. Look at the pattern down here. Underscore matches everything. It's just an unnamed pattern. So you can give names to patterns, and then later you can refer to what that pattern matched by the name, in this case A and B, and then it works with x squared y. I don't know why it matches x cubed and not the other thing. That is really strange. I'm very puzzled. Sorry about this. Now, you can also use multiple underscores. A single underscore matches one thing. If you put two underscores, then it matches one or more things. And if you have three underscores, then it matches zero or more things. So no, I expect this. Ah, okay, I'm confused. Sorry about that. The last case that I wanted to present, you can also have a pattern. For example, this matches everything that is either y or a z. So it's a pattern that has an OR operation. So this matches both elements, y and z. I'll have to think about the patterns up there. That confuses and puzzles me why they didn't work as expected.
I have a question.
Yes.
About the select function. So suppose, and this is actually suppose I have a list of lists and I want to apply the select function for each of the lists.
You would map the select function.
Hmm?
You would map
yeah,
the select
I
function.
Yeah, but I still have to use that the hash symbol in both cases. So both for the function I want to apply to.
Yes.
And the select, and surely these two can't be the same thing, so somehow I have to use two different hashes. Does that work?
Okay, yes. In that case, you can use function instead of the select function. Remember the function
okay.
I have up here?
Yeah.
Here, this one on top of the screen, and then you can give names to things. Alternatively, if it's as complicated, you can also define a module. And in
yeah.
the module, you have a local variable, and that variable is the function. So functions can be variables. So you define a local variable called f, and
yeah.
that is your matching function, and that also makes it more readable. So these anonymous functions, functions without names, make sense. But if you have too many of these anonymous functions and have them nested in each other, then maybe you do want to introduce names just to ensure that you don't confuse yourselves.
Another question. question. Do you know how to incorporate assumptions into pattern matching? So like if you wanted, or like more like select. So like if you wanted to select all the positive elements and you explicitly assume that x is greater than 0.
Oh, good question. Now, if you said the global variable dollar assumptions,
yeah,
that applies to everything. And that may work or it may not work. Otherwise, you can have a pattern where you match everything that is larger than 0, and you also match x or also match symbols. And you can also have if statements in pattern that is the slash semicolon operator. And then, for example, you match explicitly x. I'd have to look at the particular case. It's not straightforward, probably. Now, you can match patterns. You can also replace things. For example, let's look at list 2 again. That was this list that we're having. And we can take that list and replace x by 4. And then, of course, we get this. X is replaced. And after replacing that, if Mathematica finds 4 squared, it gets turned into 16 and so on. You can match x to the nth power, where n is a pattern, and you place it with x to the n plus 1, where x must appear explicitly, and n is a pattern, and this is the integer, sorry, the value that was matched here. And then you get, as expected, x cubed and x to the fourth, and x cubed y, just increase the exponent by 1. You can match all n's that are integers and replace those by 2n, which matches 2 for 6. And it also matches the exponents up here. So this replacement doesn't just work on the top level. It works on all levels, on all the sub-expressions as well. You can replace everything by 2 everything plus 1. Then, of course, you get a bit more complicated expressions here. Mm. Yes? Mm.
So x didn't go to x squared.
Because x that doesn't have a power in it.
Uh-huh.
That was the tree that I just showed. Uh-huh. X is just x. There's no power function in there. So if you want to do that, then you'd have to write it differently with a map function, for example. You also notice that this integer function here, that replacement, it does not only apply to each list element, but also to sub-expressions, to the exponents and in there. And if you want to say something goes to 2 something plus 1, then you probably want to apply that transformation only to each element of the list and not to all sub-expressions as well. That wouldn't make sense. So you would use map instead, not pattern matching. And here's a conditional. All the a's, where a is not equals to 1, I'll go to 0. This matches the 1 in the list. Where do we have the list? Here. That's the original 1. This is unchanged. These integers go to 0. X, Y, Z are not equal to 1. They do not count as equal to 1 because Mathematica doesn't know the value. So they do not get changed. And here you have x squared and x cubed. The 2 and 3, the exponents, get set to 1. Sorry, get set to 0. And x to the 0, Mathematica assumes that is 1. So this, in the end, gets replaced by the integer 1. OK. I see some of you puzzled. Maybe there was too much. But at least you've seen all the functionality that Mathematica has here. You have questions for that? Pardon? Okay, so the original list is still up there on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably holding that way. And this takes the list, and this matches everything and calls the pattern A, and that's kind of a conditional and if statement. So everything, if everything is not equal to 1, is set to 0. That's a placement that is called a pattern guard. That pattern matches only if A is not 1. The first element of the list is 1, so the pattern doesn't match. So nothing happens. These are 2 and 3. They are not equal to 1, so the pattern matches. So it's replaced by 0. These elements are x, y, and z. Mathematica doesn't know the values of x, y, z. So Mathematica doesn't know that they are equal to 1. So the pattern does not match. because it matches only if Mathematica can prove that they're not equal to 1. So they remain unchanged, x, y, z. Here, the x squared and x cubed, Mathematica knows nothing about the x, but the pattern matching also goes into the sub-expression. So the exponents 2 and 3 there are replaced by 0, because 2 and 3 are not equal to 1. And x to the 0 is 1. So I think Mathematica assumes internally that everything to the 0th power is 1. 0 to the 0th power is 1 as well. Yes?
How do you choose whether it applies to just the list elements or to the exponents as well? Because it looks like the syntax you've got for the last two expressions are pretty much the same. However, the first one applied just to the list elements, but the second one...
No, this pattern matching always applies recursively to the whole expression. Oh, this, as soon as a pattern matches an expression, it treats that expression, and then it doesn't look into that thing that matched anymore. There's another syntax where you write slash, slash, dot, that when it matches something, it reprocesses it again, and does that again until an expression doesn't match anymore. So there's a whole tree of expressions, actually. We can just look at it. We have list 2 up here, tree. Form, this now should be really large. And the pattern matching begins at list, then it looks at all the sub-elements, then the sub-expressions and the sub-expressions, and it walks the whole tree. And as soon as a pattern matches, the slash dot processes that and does not look at the sub-expressions of that. It continues to the next one. And if you use slash slash dot, then it would also continue to process it further down.
In this spread.
Pardon?
I mean, that pattern matching where you're changing n to n plus 1 and stuff like that works not only for upper indices, but also for...
No, this looks for... This here is a power operator. This looks for power, so it matches this expression and this expression and this expression,
right,
wherever it sees power.
I mean, if you define in your list something that it's y sub 8, let's say, right, with a lower index.
We can do that.
The pattern matching also will change.
It will also walk through indices down there. Yes, let me just change the list up here. Y sub 8, or how do you write that? Like this?
Yeah.
Good. And then if we look at the tree form, then Y sub 8 is a subscript of Y comma 8. And pattern matching would also go through that. So the 8 would be replaced by the 0, for example. Where here you should get y sub 16 at the end, because all the integers are replaced by 2. So pattern matching knows nothing about mathematical identities. It just looks at the internal tree and modifies the tree, which can be useful if you have a huge expression, but it can also do too much, in which case you'd have to be careful. Okay. In case I managed to thoroughly confuse all of you. And let me save that and move on to the next one.
Can you, one last question.
Of course.
Yeah. When you're changing in the input 67, you're changing a for 2a plus 1, right?
Yes.
So if I don't specify that a has to be an integer, it will only change the elements of the list, I mean, the powers are not...
Changing. Yeah, so what happens here is that it looks at all the elements of the list. And since the pattern matches everything, each of these things are going to match. For example, here, this power is going to match. And then it replaces this power by 2 times that expression plus 1. And since it processed that power, it's now then moving on to the next one. It doesn't look at x and 3. Because I write only slash dot. If I write slash, slash dot, it would look at the sub-expressions as well. And I don't know, I mean, with 2a plus 1, that may not make sense, because that would then lead to an infinite tree if you process the sub-expressions again and again and again.
Can you explain how that business of slash, slash dot works?
Okay, yeah. Let's.
Is the number of slashes indicative of how many levels down
no.
the tree form it goes?
No. Slash dot just means do it once, but as soon as something has matched, it doesn't go into it any further. So let's look at a different list. Let's call it list three. I'm not very imaginative here. And let's say we have x and f of x and f of x and one more. And let's now use pattern matching and replace f of x with something else. Oh no, let's make it interesting, right? We have f of x, f of y, f of z, and of a here. And now let's replace f of q. So this matches any f of any argument, and the argument is called q. And let's replace this with what? Sine of q, for example. And then you see what happens. X didn't match, nothing was transformed. This f matched, it gets turned into the sine function with the same argument. This f was matched, the outermost one gets turned into the sine function, but since it was matched, nothing else happens to the sub-expression, it goes on. This f remains unchanged. And here sine, the same thing, but the argument isn't actually transformed. And now we can take the same thing and use / dot.
So the mathematical works from left to right, I guess, from like within the tree, like so you know you have power and then
it works top to bottom. I'm not sure about left to right. Maybe it does, but maybe it does it also in parallel. I don't think there's a particular order implied. So in principle, all these list elements could be transformed at the same time. So there's no particular order implied because it all happens independently. And this now becomes this. It continues to work. So here the F was matched, and then it looks at the sub-expressions in here as well.
What about the Q?
The Q was just a name that we gave to the pattern.
Okay.
Whatever this matches is preserved over here.
Okay.
So the third one, shouldn't it have stopped at, shouldn't you have a sine, and then F of A, why did it automatically go right through if we just...
Slash dot does one level?
Yeah.
/ does all levels. That has nothing with two levels. No. It does not do two levels. It just does this thing and does this thing again and does this thing again. But why don't we do that manually, actually? We can do this and this again. And then you see that the last F here is actually replaced. It replaces f by sine, and then we replace f by sine again. And of course, we can do it one level more. And what happens if we do it another time? Nothing happens, because there's no f in anymore. So nothing happens. And this is what / dot does. It transforms the expression, and again, and again, and again, until the expression doesn't change anymore. So this is actually what / dot would do. Okay. I think now we can show you something cool that will mostly amaze you, but it's nothing to do with mathematics. There's a thing called current image in Mathematica. And this shows you, takes a second or something. Hello? It uses the webcam and takes the current image. And then you can continue to do image processing with that. So this is how I look on my computer. Current image 3 takes 3 snapshots and displays them. So if you move, they look slightly different. This will take 30 images and play them, list animate. I should move a bit. So it takes a short movie and plays the movie. And you see the movie player up here. Pardon? And Mathematica has many image manipulation functions in there. For example, you can Okay, I hope your webcams work. No. You know the at operator? So if I define a list like this, sine of x and x, okay, I'm not reaching you anymore. Then at takes the list and turns it into function arguments. But this calculates d of sine x comma x, which just gives the cosine. You can also use the plus operator on your list that turns the list into a sum. And if you have the numbers of 1 to 10 and use the plus operator, then of course you get 55. So what we're doing down here, we're taking two images. That gives the list of two images. This then goes into a function image difference, which is the function that takes two images and calculates the difference. And then there's also dynamic, which keeps re-evaluating the thing whenever it changes. So now you should actually, hello? So this was just the difference between the images. Oh no, what's wrong? Okay, now it continues. So dynamic re-evaluates that expression all the time whenever it changes. So if you see me moving around, it takes the difference between the two images. And as I move around, of course, you see the strange thing. Of course, the colors are all off with image difference. There are also functions that turn images into grayscales to rasterize it and so on and so forth. Yeah, I don't actually know how to actually stop the dynamic from working. So let me just write an X in front of it and evaluate that. And yes, what, no? Oh. So it turns out that taking an image is an expensive operation, right? My laptop kind of freezes for half a second when it does that. I hope it works better for you. This looks cool, what is this? Two copies of me. Okay.
Does that take the list and put them as parameters of your function?
Yes, exactly. That's what it does. It works for arbitrary lists and arbitrary functions. And it's quite convenient when you want to turn a list into a function call.
The length of the list doesn't matter. I'll just get some errors.
The list length of the list is the number of arguments to a function. And if you, for example, call the signed function with two arguments, you get an error message and nothing happens, right? The sine function remains unevaluated because Mathematica doesn't know how to do sine with two arguments. Okay, now image processing, actually, I mean, here it's now a cool thing, a gag, but it's actually something that requires a lot of computing power, and it's an active field of research with face recognition and all kinds of things. And Mathematica has a full toolbox of things built in with images, scaling, resizing, zooming, and so on. And if you look at some of the help texts there, you find all the necessary functionalities. You can do astrophysics, you can take images from galaxies, images from the sky, and can try to distinguish between stars and galaxies there and automatically count galaxies and so on. And I don't know what examples Mathematica has there, but it's actually not just for fun, it is actually a real thing. Okay, do you need a 5-minute break while you play with that, or can we continue? Okay, now let's go to something more severe again, and then also something that is maybe a bit more fun again, if we have time. So this is a notebook I got from Pedro Vieira. Pedro is a Mathematica expert faculty member here. And here this is about defining gamma matrices. Yesterday someone asked how to define an algebra, and this defines an algebra for gamma matrices. You also notice the cool notebook color, that there's a function somewhere. In, I don't know, format or cell where you can choose different skins for notebooks. And of course, that looks much cooler than the black and white that I use, but why not? So this defines the algebra for gamma matrices, how to commute them and so on. It's a bit complex and I didn't want to write that on the fly. So let's just go through that in the beginning. This mostly mixes and matches everything that I introduced yesterday and today, but it puts them together in ways that is slightly what you call it? Surprising maybe. So you know about rules and you know about lists. Of course you can have lists of rules, but unless you've seen that, you may not have expected that. So here you set an attribute for a function. Delta is a function or an operator, and you can set attributes to functions, and the attribute is orderless. Typically, if you have a function, the order of arguments matters, but not always. The plus function, for example, the argument order doesn't matter. The arguments commute. And all the less function are functions where you can change the order of the arguments, and then Mathematica will automatically put the orders in a normal form. So for example, if you write plus is an orderless function of y, x, and use full form to get the same syntax, then Mathematica, you see, will have changed the order to plus x, y. And we do the same thing here with the delta, which is going to be the Kronecker delta, because the order of arguments there doesn't matter. And if it's orderless, then Mathematica will automatically rearrange them, which is nice for pattern matching. If you try to match 1, 2, and you have 2, 1 given, then the pattern will match, because pattern matching knows about orderless functions. Numeric Q is a built-in function in Mathematica that checks whether something is numeric. We define our own attribute numQ, and we say everything that is numeric Q is true, is numeric. And these deltas here, the Kronecker deltas, we also call them numeric. And everything else is not numeric. And then later we can change whether something is numeric, and can make pattern matching decisions based on that, like a small helper function. And then we have rules. And these rules define the simplification rules for gamma matrices. Yes?
What is numeric Q?
Something is numeric if it's a number. For example, x is a symbol that's not numeric.
Okay.
You can have strings that is not numeric, but something like 1 or square root of 1 or that would be numeric things. So 2.5 or 16, these are numeric. And now we define our own numeric, kind of numq instead of numeric q, we're renaming the function. And we say these delta matrices, the Kronecker, they are also numeric. We're going to use that later on. And these are simplification rules, lists of rules for how expressions containing gamma matrices should be simplified, should be put into a normal form. And these rules are not going to be applied automatically, but if you have any expression, you can apply that rule, and then it's going to be simplified, and the commutator rules are applied, and so on. Now, there's again something here. There's a function called center dot in Mathematica. And this function doesn't have any particular meaning. It's not defined. But if you enter something using center dot, then it's going to be displayed on the screen in a cute form, namely with a center dot in between. So it just looks nice. And you have x, y again. Then it looks like this. And you know center dot is not an orderless function. The order of the function arguments is actually preserved. So what you see here with these dots, this is just center dot written in a particular syntax, is the same thing. And for multiplying gamma matrices, we're going to use this center dot function. You can't use the regular multiplication operator because of that commutes, and we couldn't have that with gamma matrices. So we need to use some other multiplication operator. And that center dot is just the function call that we're going to use for that because it is displayed in a nice manner. And this is a list of rules separated by commas. So the first rule is kind of goes over two lines here. Probably the most complicated rule. Let's begin with that anyway. We have a gamma matrix with one index. So this is for any number of dimensions, not just four dimensions. Another gamma matrix with index b. And these are arbitrary expressions here. This is c with three underscores. You maybe can't see it on the screen. And that means these are arbitrarily many arguments, maybe zero arguments, maybe 1, 2, 3 or more arguments. This means this is any expression that has anything in the beginning, we call it C, anything in the end that is called D, C and D can be empty. And then right next to each other, we have two gamma matrices with indices A and B. This is what it's going to be replaced with, and this is the if statement. And the if statement says, not ordered A and B. This is a list with A and B, and lists can be ordered or unordered. An ordered list means that each element is less than or equal the next element. Ordered Q is again a built-in function in Mathematica. So if A and B are both 1 or 1 and 2, then this is going to be ordered. So not ordered is going to be false. So nothing is going to happen it. So this pattern will only match if you get two matrices and they have the wrong order. So say 3 and 1. And this is then going to be, well, you see it's going to commute the gammas. There's a minus sign added. You get the Kronecker, and C and D are just added in beginning and end unchanged from whatever they matched. Again, C may be empty or nothing. So it just looks for any expression, a series of multiplication, a series of products, my English. And then if the gamma matrices are not in canonical order, they are commuted and the commutator is applied. The next rule, a similar case, except A and A. So these two patterns must match the same thing. Then this gets turned into a Kronecker delta. These are arbitrary expressions, and A2 is numeric. So this term here in the middle is either a number, 2, 3, 15, or it's a product of Kronecker deltas. Yes?
What's with the funny arrow?
Okay. I showed you a regular error, and a regular error is the same as with the equals and colon equals yesterday. A regular error has the right-hand side evaluated immediately, and if you write colon error, then it's a delayed evaluation. And you do not want this to be evaluated immediately. You want a delayed evaluation. I don't know, maybe because this not ordered you. Well, just the not ordered you can only be evaluated after A and B actually matched. So you need to use the funny queue here, the delayed evaluation here. Otherwise, the not ordered queue would be evaluated when you define the rule, not when you apply the rule. And this doesn't make sense, because when you define the rule, you don't know what A and B are. They're just variables, placeholders. So if A2 is numeric, then you can pull it out in front and use a regular multiplication and attach it to the first factor, A1. Yes?
Where you said there are three underscores for the two expressions of the size.
Yes. That means zero or more terms can be there. So anything can be there.
So if I put just one underscore, what's the difference?
If you put one underscore, it's going to match one element.
Okay.
If you have two underscores, it matches one or more elements. And three underscores, zero or more elements.
Okay.
So this is elements of a list, or in this case, function arguments to center dot. So center dot, I mean, has a series of function arguments, and it matches zero or more of that. Here we have A2, A4. A2 is numeric, and then we can pull that numeric factor out and put it, attach it to A1. So what these two rules does, everything that is numeric, everything that is not gamma matrices, is going to commute it to the very front of the expression, just to get a normal form. That you have 2 gamma times 2 gamma becomes 4 gamma times gamma. You want to have a normal form. You want to have all expressions in the same form. And here you just distribute the plus sign in the regular way. If you have center dot of center dot, if you have an expression with parentheses, then the flatten, so you know flatten works for lists. Actually, it works for anything. Here, in this case, it works for center dots as well. You just flatten that. Flatten respects the arguments, the order of the arguments, but it removes the nesting. And then we also know the value of Kronecker deltas. So if you just have a Kronecker delta with the same index, it's the number of dimensions. If you have a square of Kronecker with two different arguments, then it's the number of dimensions. And here you have a rule, a Kronecker delta with two indices, A1 and A2, times an expression A3. And free Q means that A3 is free of A1, that A1 does not appear in A3. So if you have an expression A3 and the index A1 actually appears in A3, then A1 is replaced by A2 in that expression. And this is then how the Kronecker delta is applied. This, of course, makes a particular assumption of that this is really just the sum of products in here. This is not the generic rule. It's kind of a simplification, make it easier to write this down. And this gives you then a basic set of rules how to simplify and canonicalize expressions with gamma matrices. Let me remove that. I hope this doesn't kill too much. Yes. Oh, no, let me evaluate that. And then if you have this long product of gamma matrices, then this turns into this expression. So first, we apply all the rules. And I use slash dot here. It applies the rule, sees if something changed. If something changed, it applies the rule again, and so on, and so on, until nothing changes anymore. And then it's fully simplified. And then if we have a center dot of a single term, then we just have the single thing. Then center dot is not necessary anymore. It's like a product with a single term. It's just correspond to the single term. And in the end, we apply the function simplify to everything. And this is then the expression. It's all numeric factors. And there's this one gamma matrix at the end that's left over in this particular example. You have questions? So this is taking everything and a bit more of what I described yesterday and today and show you how it can use if apply all these features together. This, of course, is a hugely complicated example. I wouldn't expect you, if you're new to Mathematica, to be able to write that. But this gives you a glimpse of how you can combine all the individual features, the function calls and the pattern matching and the rules and lists and everything and put it together to something that is really powerful and how you can define something that is really complex in a very compact manner and still have it halfway readable. If this is a very concise way of describing the commutators and how you get to a canonical form of products involving gamma matrices. I didn't put Pedro Vera's name on the notebook, but that was designed by him. I just presented it today. He often gives Mathematica summer schools, and this is probably a notebook that he used last year for a summer school who maybe asked for last year's science class. How much time do we have? Okay. Okay. So this is the regular operator, minus something. And this is the other one, the delayed one. And if you write A and B and, yeah, then it actually, if I type another letter, then Mathematica automatically replaces that. Good. Something quick, we talked yesterday about aborting an expression if too much time passes. In other places, in computer design, it's called a watchdog timer. It's like a timer that watches something else. And if something else takes too long, the watchdog timer would set off an alarm. For example, if you have anti-lock brakes in the car, then of course it's a small computer, and that computer could crash. So there's a small watchdog timer applied, and every 10 milliseconds or something, if the computer doesn't apply, it's rebooted. So the computer looking for the anti-lock brakes probably rebooted every 10 milliseconds just to make sure that it doesn't crash and that the anti-lock brakes continue to work. Here's something else. Here I define a function, which I call f slow, because it's the slow function. Oh, sorry, the size. Okay. This function does two things. First, pause I. So I is the argument of the function. It waits for I seconds. And then it returns the value I. And with semicolon, you can just chain multiple things to each other. And the parentheses are just ensuring that this is the whole function. So if we evaluate that function of 3, then it takes 3 seconds and returns the value 3. Now we create a list of this fslow functions, fslow of I, where I goes from 1 to 10. And then, of course, for I equals 1, it takes 1 second, 2 seconds, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And to evaluate the last function, it would take 10 seconds. We don't want to do that. We want to do a time-constrained evaluation. So we evaluate the fslow time-constrained. We wait at most 5 seconds. And if we had to wait too long, we return 0 instead of the actual function result. And since we call time-constrained 10 times and wait at most 5 seconds, this is probably going to take 50 seconds now. Yes, it's not a good example, because now I have to kill 50 seconds of time. But can you guess what the result would be? So in principle, it's the table of a function that always returns the argument from I to 10. So in principle, you expect the result to be just the list of numbers from 1 to 10, my standard example, except that fslow takes too long. So some of the list elements will have to be replaced by 0, because they couldn't be evaluated quickly enough. Hey, there's the result. Very good. So 1, 2, 3, 4, that worked fine. The time fslow evaluated for the value 4, 4 seconds, that's OK. And here, fslow takes 5 seconds. Well, 5 seconds and a bit, apparently. Time constraint was, in this case, faster, because it waits at most 5 seconds. So it turns 0. And all the other ones, the the result is also zero because if slow took too long to evaluate, so it just aborted the evaluation, cut it off and returned the zero instead. So this is now, yeah. So here I took something from Mathematica's help text, Mathematica's examples. Let me just run the notebook first before I actually describe what it does. There's a function evaluate notebook, which runs through the whole notebook top to bottom and evaluates all the functions. Oh no, what is this? I ran it yesterday, I swear. Clang, no such file or directory. Okay, well. So this was an example of low-level programming. And now it's a beautiful example of why you don't want to use low-level programming, because it actually doesn't work. Here, I took it from numerical examples. And if you scroll to the bottom, no, where is it? Where is it? Yeah, it didn't. So this is what it should have calculated. You remain the factorial that is called the Mandelbrot set. And this is what that notebook should have calculated. And then it only calculates it, it compiles the function to C. And if you compile a function to C, then it can execute much faster. So it should be able to evaluate a picture in about 10 milliseconds. And then you can interactively zoom into that thing. And it's all done in Mathematica. So if you think that Mathematica is slow, that's not always true. You can even do complex definitions like this. We can briefly go through the notebook here and say what that should have done, would have done. Probably all that's missing is some kind of statement where the compile function or something is declared up there, but not. So this is the actual, oh, wow. It's a colleague from Baton Rouge. No, I don't have time for a call right now. Are you familiar with the Mandelbrot set and how this is defined? So it's a very simple function. And you look whether the function converges or not, or you approximately look whether it converges. So it's a recursion relation where you set x0 is defined to be 0. X is a complex number. Xn plus 1 is xn squared plus c. C is a complex number. And then you look at this relation for all the complex numbers C in the complex plane, and this will either converge or will not converge. You know, if C is very large, then obviously each xn plus 1 will be much larger than C, and it will quickly diverge. In particular, if the absolute value of C is larger than 2, you can immediately see that it will always diverge. On the other hand, if C is very small, close to 0, then you take that and then you square the previous result, and if you square something that is close to 0, it gets smaller again. You add a bit something, so near the region of 0 actually is where this function converges. And of course, proving whether it converges or doesn't converge is actually quite complicated. So you take a shortcut, you apply this thing 100 times, and after 100 iterations, it's either larger, the absolute value of x is either larger than 2 or not. If it's larger than 2, you know it diverges. If it's smaller than 2, you assume it converges. And then you color the, then you can produce an image of the complex plane for different values of C, and you use either a black or white to indicate whether it converged or doesn't converge. Or if it diverged, you can kind of estimate how quickly it diverged, and this is how you get the cool color schemes in the image. And that's a very simple function, and this is how it's defined here. Input is a value C, and actually this one uses 1,000 iterations. There's a big while loop. If the maximum number of iterations has not been reached, and if the absolute value is less than 2, then okay, it's called Z here, not X, then you square it and add Z and go to the next iteration. And you do that until either the absolute value of z is larger than 2, or the maximum number of iterations has been reached, and the value returned, if you reach the maximum number of iterations, it returns 0. Otherwise, you return the number of iterations that were needed to evaluate that. And then everything where, thing where 0 is returned, where it actually where it diverged, you get, when I'm confusing myself. OK, yes, no, not a good time, no, sorry. And then you can color it correspondingly. And that function is rather easy to write. And now the idea is to actually compile the function to C. So if you compile a function, the basic idea, that's the low-level programming, is that you put restrictions on the possible input values of the functions, and then you can spend time optimizing the functions. For example, the restriction is that C needs to be a complex number. And it doesn't have an arbitrary precision. It will use at most 15 digits of precision, and so on and so forth. And that makes the function less flexible, but it can be executed much more quickly. And this compile function is built into Mathematica. There are other options, compilation target C. C is the fastest way to run the function end to end. Runtime option speed, meaning try to get a function that is as fast as possible. And then you can evaluate this MCF, Mathematica compiled function. I don't know why they call it MCF. And then there are other things further down that I don't want to get into at the bottom. You have to choose a color map, which consists of random numbers. There is, you also choose the points in the complex plane where you evaluate that from a minimum to a maximum, just a raster of points. Then you compile another function where you call this first compiled function for each of the points that you have. And yeah, and this is defining a nice user interface that, well, the user interface function is really complicated, but what you get is a nice user interface with sliders, and well, here should be the image that is not here. And with the mouse, you can then move the image, you can pan in, you can zoom out, you can move the sliders, and so on and so forth. You can probably try it out yourself. If you look at this Mathematica documentation, the tutorial numerical methods, you can copy and paste all the functions in there. Fortunately, I can't show it because something's fishy with the C compiler that's not found. Mm-mm. You had a question? OK. Good. Well, not good. You should have questions, but that's that. OK. There's also one function that I wanted to mention here, absolute timing. Did I have that yesterday? Yes, I mentioned timing yesterday, which shows how long the function took. And that shows you the speed, the interactivity that you get. Well, so I can't show that. Sorry for that. Yes, a good question. So actually, the way this function is compiled, it's also parallelized. My computer has 8 cores, or 4 cores, depending on your code. The function is parallelized. So I believe that timing counts the number on all cores and adds them up, whereas absolute timing just loses the largest of the ones. So absolute timing would be what is also called the wall time, the time you have to wait, whereas timing would be the total compute time that the computer has spent. And there can be a factor of up to 8 difference. But if you look for interactivity, then you don't care how many cores are used. That's why it would be absolute timing. OK. And in the last 5 minutes that I have, I want to show you about remote access and parallel computing, which Mathematica can also do. Clean, cell, delete all output. There we go. This is the original input. Parallel table is just table, except it's run in parallel. So if you have multiple cores, it could return a result faster. Here you see. No parallel kernels available. It runs in serial. Of course, the result is the same. If you go to evaluation and parallel kernel configuration, then you can use multiple cores. Your laptops may have multiple cores. Local kernels, can you see that? We probably do. This says local kernels. I can enable local kernels. Then Mathematica will start multiple local kernels. Automatically chooses 8 because I have 8 cores in my laptop. And you can look at the parallel kernel status. You see at the moment there is only one kernel started. I can launch multiple kernels. Now I have altogether 9 Mathematica kernels running. And Now the parallel table runs 8 times as fast. Yeah, of course, right? It takes 10 milliseconds, so you can't really see the difference. But that's that. If something takes longer, you would see the difference. If you were to put a pause statement in there, for example, then you would see that the pause statements are executed in parallel, so it goes faster. And system information shows you information about the computer that you're using here. For example, my computer, call it Redshift. Yeah, it's so fast, you only see the Redshift. You can also use parallel kernels, sorry, remote kernels. That's also interesting if your laptop is too slow. We have some fast servers that you could using. And if you go to kernel configuration, you can define remote kernels. I don't want to go into the details of that. But if you have them defined, then you can switch the notebook's kernel. I hope you can read that. For example, to compute, this is one of the remote kernels are defined. Now it takes a bit. Now it sets up a connection to compute. And now if I run parallel kernel here, then it launches kernels on compute. And you see the prefix compute here indicating that this calculation runs on the fast server. So now again, you get the numbers from 1 to 10 even faster. Of course, that doesn't make sense. But with system information, you now see that it's running on a different, no, hey. Ah, no, it's doing something. Running on a different computer. The machine is called compute, and it's now a Unix PC instead of a MacBook, what I have here. And setting this up is unfortunately a bit more low level and a bit more complicated than you would like, but Mathematica offers these features. And if you need that or want to know more about that, then you can contact me. I'm in Office 350 or send me an email. Okay, I think this was that for today. Hope you had fun with the webcam. Do you have other questions on what I presented today? Hmm?
Parallel table, but every other function does have its parallel version?
No, there are a few functions that have a parallel version, and there is also a function parallelize, where you can give a generic expression, and it will try to parallelize the expression. And it doesn't work as well as you'd hope it should work, unfortunately, but you can see a speed up. Links, you can link to other facilities, OpenCL. Do you know OpenCL or CUDA? So you can do OpenCL and CUDA programming with Mathematica. Let me load the OpenCL link. I hope that is installed on compute. I'm rerunning the system information command. Oh, it's not supported on the system. Okay, let me switch back to my laptop here. And then you see that you can use OpenCL. And with OpenCL, you have more computing power. There are two devices available on the system. This is the CPU, and this is the GPU. So if you were to run the Mandelbrot on the GPU, it would probably run even faster. Faster means you can have something even larger and then zoom in even more smoothly. Of questions. I think there's one notebook I didn't show. Is that correct? No, no, I showed all the notebooks. So the notebooks of what I showed, minus the interactive changes I made, should be available on the wiki if you want to look at them. Okay. There won't be a tutorial this afternoon, so I'll see you tomorrow morning again. Have a nice day.